The woman drew herself up to her full 5'10" of quite shapely woman. Not uncomely when you look through the dirt.
We are the Barbaras, a race of women warriors. No men are allowed to join us. So it is written in our holy book, Man the Enemy. The only writing remaining to our ancestors after the Great Blast, the Man-Made Blast. It is the man who has laid waste to our world, and thus it is the man whom we shun and despise for all his habits. When men come into our land, we attack them and use them for their ability to procreate. We use them for a few days, getting as many of the fertile women pregnant as we can. Then, when their sperm runs dry, they are beheaded. Their bodies are fed to the sacred fire, and their heads are piled on stakes around our holy church. But we have failed. No women have become pregnant for 2 years. It is a bad omen, for many of the women are growing old, past childbearing age. Soon, we may die.
She paused, looked at the muscled slab of a man in front of her, and got a strange look in her golden eyes.
You can help me. I shall be as a goddess back there. I will be pregnant. And they will feed me and not hurt me anymore. For I am not well liked now. And they punish me for no reason.
She immediately pulled off her rags and furs and stood before him naked. In spite of himself, Rock felt the desire rise in his loins. She was beautiful. Muscled from head to toe, with firm, grapefruit-sized breasts that pointed straight ahead, and a patch of midnight black hair between her legs. There was an animal wildness in her eyes that Roxanne had never seen in a woman before, and it aroused him. She walked slowly toward him, her arms outstretched. Rock was hypnotized, unable to resist even if he had wanted to. She reached forward with a smile on her flushed lips and undid Roxanne's belt. She let the pants fall to the ground and then took off his jacket and khaki work shirt. She rubbed up against him like a cat, moaning and writhing against his hard flesh. She pulled him down to the cool earth atop a thick cushion of cottony green moss.
Now.
Her long nails dug into Rock's back and ripped razor-like cuts that just penetrated the skin down to his waist. Rock didn't know if he was fucking or fighting, but he went with it. She grew more and more frantic, her eyes flaring like a burst of golden fire, and she opened wide for him so he could go into her very core. Her body arched and contracted in powerful spasms. Rock felt his own desire reach its culmination and let out an explosion of molten fire that rocketed up into her center. She swooned. Her head fell to the side, and she was totally silent. Rock pulled the fur she had dropped over them, and she pressed close, kissing and touching him. Rock guiltily thought of Kim, but this was not exactly an affair that would last. Besides, he was doing it to help an entire race avoid extinction. After about a half an hour, she reached her hand down for him, and they went at it again, and again, and again. In the morning, Rock woke to the sounds of birds standing all around him, chirping at him with mocking faces. Even Snorter, about 20 feet away, nibbling on some choice orange-petaled flowers, glanced up at Rock and seemed to shake his head. Rock smiled, remembering the night. He looked around. She was gone. And so was his hunting knife. But she could have tried to kill him, and hadn't. She needed the blade more than he did, anyway. He got dressed, aching as he rose from the clawing and biting she had done the night before. He headed back to the rest of the party, and with the bright sun and a path that he found, Labrid pulled up by the pond with the sun only risen 3 hours. They'd be able to get a good start on the day, and Ra could detour them around the village of the Barbaras. McCoughlin's warthog sausage and eggs filled the air with a heady aroma, as did the black coffee perking away in rising trails of delicious steam.
Hey man, where you been?
You wouldn't believe me if I told you.
Charlie Whiskers sidled up the narrow gully between two towering rock faces and stopped dead in his tracks as he saw the reflections of guns glinting from above in the afternoon sun.
Hold it, boys! It's me, Charlie Whiskers, remember? I was here a few weeks ago. I got them hides y'all was asking for.
The red spy looked around innocently, patting his mule, which was covered way above its head with beaver, muskrat, and gold coon pelts.
Your man, Mr. Atkins, I think it was? He ordered these dang things. Now come on, a deal's a deal.
Two men emerged from thick bushes about 50 feet up the rocky slope, their guns still trained on Whiskers. They looked him over carefully. The taller guard, his face dark and deeply lined from years in the sun, stepped closer.
Who sent you?
No one sent me, gosh dang it. I'm delivering an order. I tell you, I came here 2 weeks ago and talked to your supply man, and he made a verbal deal with me. Said just bring them around and get paid in bullets and knives. Maybe a few bottles of hooch, too.
He licked his lips and winked at the two free fighters, two of nearly 100 heavily armed guards who surrounded the convention ranch. The two men looked at each other and then back at the grizzled old trader. He had to be all right. No red could look or act like that. The men let their guns drop slowly and their stern faces relaxed as they waved the fur man forward with their hands.
Come on, old-timer. We'll buy your furs.
Well now, that's more like it.
Charlie Whiskers grinned from ear to ear, revealing three missing teeth that had been surgically removed by dental surgeons back in Moscow. The teeth were waiting in a jar in a sub-zero chamber awaiting his return when they would be reimplanted in his mouth.
If he gets some of that hooch, though, don't you forget to stop here on the way out and share a little.
Oh, I won't be forgetting. Oh, no, I won't be forgetting at all.
He pulled the mule on as they wound their way along the ancient creek bed for nearly a mile. Colonel Kozlovsky was beside himself with excitement. He had done it. He had infiltrated the highest-ranking, most protected of all free fighter enclaves. At this very moment, their top leaders, their so-called president, would be coming. Let them gather. He would bide his time until the trap was full. Then he would spring it. He would make general for sure. At the end of the gully, he came to a large field of pink and orange daisies and dandelions, and then thick woods. At each new terrain, guards stopped him and challenged his right to enter. In every case, his disguise and hill talk, his wads of chewing tobacco, fooled them all. They had all seen Russian agents before, but they had been obvious and quickly disposed of. This was a new breed of infiltrator, with whom they had no familiarity. An infiltrator who walked ever deeper into the very heart of the rebel camp. After nearly 2 hours of zigzagging trails and directions from guards, he came to a mountainside covered with towering pines. About 500 feet up sat a tremendous log cabin, once a hunting resort lodge in the old, more pleasure-filled days of America. He pulled up to a thick grove of vines and branches. Looking around, he reached below the mule's pack belt and pressed a small transmitter to on. The coordinates would be sent. The order would be given. And New America would be the shortest-lasting country in the history of the world. Georgie, the head waiter at the elite KGB commissary on the 79th floor of the monolith, walked into the kitchen carrying Colonel Kilov's tray in one hand and nodded to the short, squat chef, Yusuk.
He is still playing with his toy soldiers. When can we...
Silence! Not now! Hold on. There might be microphones in here. Now, talk.
He's a madman. Hold up in his office up there with all the shades drawn and sunglasses on, playing with his little dolls. He was bad before the assassination attempt. Now he is totally gone. His mind snapped. I'm fearful that he'll have us all executed if he doesn't like the soup or I drop a glass or anything.
Perhaps we should act soon. Perhaps poison?
No, don't even think it. Look what happened to that assassin who got into the hospital. One of the orderlies told me the man had no skin on his flesh when they took him away.
They both shuddered and went back to their tasks. Georgie picked up the glass he was to take to the colonel and inspected it carefully for grease spots. A tiny speck could mean death for the whole staff when the commander of all the Blackshirts was in an especially paranoid mood. He poured some white wine, chilled to Kilov's exact specifications, with a shaking hand.
I know an untraceable...
No time to talk! Quickly now! I said I need Kilov's meal. Breast of chicken in white cream sauce and asparagus au gratin? Got to get back quickly.
Here you are, my friend.
Georgie left the hot kitchen and headed down the hallway at a half run, expertly balancing the full tray after 27 years of experience. He silently entered the chamber of the skull, who sat smiling to himself at his nearly 20-foot-long curved marble table with veins of red and gold rippling through it. In front of him were 4-foot-high dolls that he was rearranging in order, the order in which he wanted to kill them. They were cast from plastic, accurate features painted on their faces, representations of those who stood in Kilov's way to world domination. First was thin, stooped Premier Vasily, and next to him, his ever-present black servant, Rahala, who, according to the colonel's agents in Moscow, had been the reason the doctor's conspiracy had failed. The drug-crazed madman moved his gaze onto the next doll, Zhabnov, with his fat stomach and bulldog face.
Ah, you are such a fool to have sent such an orator to do your bidding. I wonder, have you heard? Have you run away to your bed of drugged American girls, tail between your legs? I know there is nothing else down there.
And finally, Roxen, the man who scarred Kilov's face and escaped the colonel's grasp. But he would have to wait. Kilov lifted Zhabnov and held him tightly and squeezed.
Feel that, fat fool. This is how you will die. Slowly.
The waiter stood speechless just inside the doorway, terrified to come in or to leave. Kilov suddenly noticed him, but smiled. He seemed pleased now, after the dolls. A nod from the colonel, and the waiter placed the food before him.
That will be all.
Georgie left as fast as he could without stumbling. He didn't know which he'd see first, a nervous breakdown or a firing squad. Premier Vasily, ruler of all the world, was feeling better all the time. Well enough to attend the annual military parade. Rahala wheeled him out to the viewing stand in front of the Kremlin, where hundreds of officials and generals paid their most obedient respects. Millions of Russians gathered along the route, cheered as he stood for the first time in a year. Before him, the armed might of the Soviet Empire passed in review. Tanks, nearly 100 feet long, shook the platform of marble and steel, emblazoned with a huge slogan in front, "One world, and it is red." There were 50 or so overcoat-clad elderly men on the balcony with the premier. Absent and dead were KGB supporters of Kilov, who had been eliminated. Never in his life had Vasily held such a grip on power in the Soviet Union. Yet never, he thought sadly, had he so little control of the outlying empire, America in particular. After a while, he grew tired of waving at the parade and sat down motionless in the warm afternoon sun. The tens of thousands of goose-stepping red troops passed him by, their Kalashnikovs held rigidly in front of their chests, pointing straight up. The MKVD police passed in review, as did the Border Patrol and the newly enlarged and lavishly uniformed Imperial Guard, Vasily's private army. So many uniforms, medals, blending, melting together, the premier dozed off in his wheelchair. When he awoke, the parade was nearly over. Thousands of agricultural workers were marching with shovels and pitchforks over their shoulders.
Rahala.
Yes, grandfather.
Wheel me out of here and into the private garden of the Politburo, the Park of Heroes.
Of course, Your Excellency.
In the Park of Heroes, birds from all over the world sang inside immense aviaries. There were birds of paradise, snow parrots and indigo doves, cardinals and blue jays, magpies and pheasants, all chirping and clucking in a cacophony of feathered song. Here, everything was in order. The Garden of Heroes belied the destruction of the outside world.
Ah, Where were we? Ah, Rahala. Let's sit here by the water fountain, and you read to me.
He handed over the book.
Chapter 8, The Queen's Croquet Ground.
The peacocks walked slowly about the garden, gazing curiously at the two figures. They would move and then freeze, as if posing for a painting. Their iridescent plumage rippled with a thousand streaks of fire, reflecting the light. Their impossible large and multicolored tails swayed back and forth as they walked. As if acting out some sort of unknown ritual, they began circling the two men in large, almost perfectly round paths. Three, four, then five of the rainbow birds joined in walking slowly, endlessly around the premier of all Russia and his servant, who stood amidst the rose trellises, reading sonorously in the strange June sunshine.